Happy holidays, FinTech Files listeners.
What are you up to for the holidays this year?
Well, since it's the first time I'm spending the holidays in Australia, I'm definitely gonna spend a lot of time on the beach. It's summer, it's warm, it's nice, like definitely a lot of time outdoors and probably just get a few friends together and do like a nice barbecue, do it like truly Australian.
Amazing. I'm sure it's a cool experience, like having Christmas holiday like this.
It's definitely something different than the German winter back home. But what about you, Annika? What are your plans?
We're flying to the Maldives. So actually, it's going to be 10 days of doing nothing but sleeping, working out, diving and eating. Really looking forward to this.
So while we're taking a break, this week we're bringing you a throwback episode from our last season. Open Banking for Good, Eyal Sivan on data, innovation and financial inclusion.
We thought it would be the perfect episode to share this week as we set our sights on the new year.
Enjoy the episode.
Open banking means different things to different people. For some people, it's a series of regulations, and to some people, it's a set of technologies. And then to some people, it's something of a global movement, an idea that when a customer has data, that data belongs to them, and they should decide how it's shared, by whom, for what purpose, and for how long.
Open banking is many things. A new set of tools, a slew of regulations, and a movement that starts with financial services and takes us way beyond that, into an age where data is both open and protected.
In today's episode, we dive into the world of open banking with one of its strongest advocates, Eyal Sivan, Mr. Open Banking himself. And no, that is not a nickname we made up. Mr. Open Banking is a podcast that gathers more than 100,000 listeners worldwide and is Eyal's platform to educate the public and discuss the latest innovations in the space.
Eyal has more than 25 years of experience in information and banking technologies. Today, he is a general manager for Ozone API, a tech pioneer who empowers global institutions to adopt open finance and thrive. It is this wealth of knowledge and expertise that Eyal brings to FinTech Files. What a privilege.
So could open banking revolutionize the way we use financial services? What is in it for consumers, banks, and even governments? What are the risks? And crucially, does it hold potential for better financial inclusion? Eyal answers all these questions in our conversation today. So here's his conversation with Norad.
Eyal's career took root in the early days of the internet. He was part of a generation that started companies in basements. How cool is that? With his first firm, Everywhere Inc., he taught himself how to use emerging computer operating systems like Unix, Perl, HTML, and he planted himself in a new ecosystem, the world of information technology. And yes, this niche would take Eyal all the way to Mr. Open Banking. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became Mr. Open Banking?
Sure. Happy to, Nora. I am a career IT professional, almost to the point of being a cliche. Back in the 90s, I had my own internet shop. Eventually, I learned about databases and how to make websites and databases work together to create what would eventually be called web applications. And eventually found a home at CIBC, a major Canadian bank, as part of their architecture team. I came in as the sort of internet and web services whiz kid. At my firm, we had started playing with early versions of XML. So I came into CIBC to clean up how they did integration and APIs. By the time I left, I held a pretty senior role in the architecture team. I was head of strategic platforms. And because we had taken a very novel approach to building APIs, creating our own in-house platform, I found myself standing on a lot of stages talking about the work we had done. People wanted to hear how exactly we had tackled the integration challenge of the modern day. In those travels, at an event in Oslo, I met a gentleman named Gunnar Berger. He was the head of open banking at Nordea, a bank out of the Nordics. And his title was what intrigued me the most. His title was head of open banking. I thought to myself, what on earth is that, open banking? So I took Gunnar out for drinks and asked him. And he said, well, don't you know, there was a regulation passed in Europe that required banks to publish standardized APIs for sharing data. After meeting Gunnar, I went back to my hotel room and started watching YouTube clips of European legislators arguing with each other about people having rights to their data and leveling the playing field and all these other very philosophical ideas. And it was a little like being struck by a bolt of lightning. I kind of fell in love. I couldn't sleep. It was keeping me up at night. I'd been working in integration for my whole career. And I knew what it meant to make an entire ecosystem standardized. And it was even more bewildering that a regulation was what was driving that to happen. I sort of became obsessed with the whole idea.
When he left his role as CIBC, AL had one objective: funding the development of his brand and launching the first three episodes of Mr. Open Banking. But going all in a venture, it's not without risk. So when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, he had to improvise. That's how AL found his next role at Axway, an API management firm that believed in the idea of open banking and wanted to sponsor his platform. AL became their head of open banking, following the footsteps of top leaders who had inspired him. Over the next 5 years, he went on to build a network of innovators, experts, influencers, who are all advancing open banking and making it a reality.
But before we dive into what this new reality looks like, AL wants to be transparent about what open banking is.
You can't talk about open banking without talking about money. Moving your money around and moving the data that's associated with your money, like your accounts, your transactions, your history, your credit records, the products that you might have, that can be really tricky. It often involves a lot of paper and phone calls and, heaven forbid, visits to branches. That is a very constraining thing. Someone like my grandma would just assume that that's how it is. That's how it's always been, and that's how it's always going to be. But the fact is, that doesn't have to be the case. We live in a world where moving data around across the internet has become part of our daily lives. When you order a taxi, when you need to get some food delivered, it's a matter of a few swipes on your phone. And the apps that make that happen often integrate a whole bunch of different capabilities, menu capabilities, maps, deliveries, payments. All of those are sort of stitched together. So what if moving money from one bank to another was as easy as swiping your finger across your phone? Or what if switching accounts between banks was just as easy? What if you could get approved for a line of credit or get financed for a large purchase you wanted to make, all with a few taps on your phone? And to do so not with a single provider, but in a way that lets you look at all the different options that were available across the providers and pick the best one for you. That's how I would explain what open banking does.
So would you say that this convenience, the new convenience of banking, and maybe also transparency around it, that is like the core mission of open banking? Or
so in terms of what's it for, what's it trying to achieve, I could broadly break it down into three buckets. The first one is competition. It came out of the 2008 financial crisis, which was more than just a financial crisis. It was a crisis of trust. A lot of people all over the world felt that they had essentially been fooled by financial services, by the banks all over the world, that they could no longer trust them. And open banking came out of an idea that to repair that trust, there had to be a distribution of financial services. There had to be a wider playing field that allowed more players to come in and more financial services to be offered. That competition would increase value and reduce a kind of corruption, the kind that had caused the irresponsibility that led to 2008. So the second bucket is this idea of doing financial services in a completely new way, innovation.
When it comes to banking, innovation isn't just about letting more people participate. It's not just widening the range of financial companies. It's also about opening the field to new pathways, letting in entirely new kinds of financial products.
The third, and often not given enough attention, is this idea of transparency. That in order for competition and innovation to thrive, you needed to be able to see through the fine print that often accompanied financial services, to compare products fairly, to see how much a line of credit cost in one place versus another, what were the terms and conditions that went with it, what were the fees associated. So those are the three big goals: competition, innovation, and transparency.
So transparency is buzzword that I want to hook onto, because when people hear data sharing between organizations, they often feel like a bit alert because they obviously don't want it to just be shared without them being in control. So how does that work within the open banking environment? Do consumers still have control over their data?
Yeah, you've hit upon a really important point, Nora. There's a bit of a misconception about open banking that it's actually unsafe. That if I combine the word open and the word banking, this conjures an image in people's mind that my data is sort of out there and exposed and anyone can just pick it up. People who don't know anything about it automatically react negatively. They don't like seeing those two words together. Open means an open door. In reality, the open means more like open source. It refers to the notion of common standards.
The point AOL is making here is substantial. Contrary to what you might expect, security is not optimized in many parts of the banking sector. Financial institutions often operate with their own security systems, which can be out of date.
It sometimes uses either very archaic practices like batch files and integration systems that are built bespoke with questionable security mechanisms, or sometimes they use a mechanism called screen scraping, which requires you to actually share your bank credentials, your card number and password, with an intermediary who is essentially tricking the bank on the other side into thinking it's you as a customer logging in, and then proceeds to scrape all the data off of the actual HTML screens. So highly insecure. And the fact is, these practices are still in place today. Open banking, by contrast, by leveraging this base of common standards, introduces some of the most stringent, powerful security controls available today, and they're continuously improving. And in general, it is one of the most secure mechanisms of providing the utility of data sharing in the world across all industries. So rather than being less safe, open banking is actually much, much more safe than data sharing practices in place today.
AL touches on another important aspect of open banking here. It is a global phenomenon. As a movement, open banking came into its own in 2018, when Europe adopted PSD2, a regulation that asked banks to open their APIs to specific third parties. The idea behind this legislation was to better integrate payments into the European market, and importantly, to provide a level playing field for service providers. And that's really interesting, because it means that from the get-go, open banking has been geared towards financial inclusion.
And that explains why, over the last 7 years, open banking has vastly expanded its reach. It has traveled quickly to the UK, Australia, Brazil, and other regions of the American continent. Now, it's even taking hold in parts of Africa and in the Middle East. To say nothing of Southeast Asia, that has actually been working with advanced API technology for a long time. All of these regions have varying needs in financial products, and in some cases, they have used open banking to better serve their communities.
It's interesting. Open banking is done for different purposes in different places. So in certain places, it is an explicit goal of open banking to support the underbanked or unbanked. A great case study here is Brazil, who managed to go from essentially a plan to one of the most mature open banking ecosystems in the world in the space of about a year. And as part of their commitment, explicitly their goal was to support underbanked and unbanked individuals. You'll find this to be very common in places where you do have a large unbanked population. The way it solves it is by essentially lowering the cost of introducing new financial services providers and lowering the cost of being able to send money to people and to allow them to send money to each other. So, for example, in Brazil, shortly after launching their open banking regime, they introduced public wallets. In Brazil, I believe it's two of the major banks are partially state-owned. What they essentially did was issued wallets to everybody, the entire population, who wanted to just come into a branch and say, here's my phone, I want you to issue me a digital wallet. It provided them a way to be able to participate in the economy by sending money to each other, applying for credit through these digital wallets, and adding to their credit history, leading to additional products, and essentially creating that financial inclusion that was ultimately their goal. But the effect was to effectively bank millions of people who were previously unbanked. And again, that's possible because standardization fundamentally lowers the costs of creating financial services. It really is a non-zero-sum game.
So this is maybe getting a bit idealistic, but could open banking contribute to lowering financial inequality in the long term? Or is there a limit to what you can achieve with open banking?
I don't want to make it sound like it's an automatic fix, right? Open banking is fundamentally the idea that by letting people own their data, you're going to create a lot more competition, create more innovation, create more utility, and fundamentally raise all boats, right? That is the dream. However, I would be remiss if I didn't say that there were risks associated with it. The fact is that if you don't have the right kinds of controls around it, the right kinds of regulation, it can sometimes help large incumbents become larger. It can help governments who want to debank people to do so. That is the risk, the idea that folks who are trying to take advantage can find ways to take advantage. Open banking creates marvelous market dynamics through competition and innovation. But ultimately, those market dynamics, in order to achieve goals like supporting the unbanked and providing social good, those market dynamics have to have the right rules and regulations backing them up to ensure you don't have that kind of digital repeat of the same concentration that led to 2008. I want to stress that that's going to be different for every region, for every country. The dynamics of how much regulation you need and how much market activity you need are going to vary. The two have to find a way to work together. In my view, the benefits far outweigh the risks.
So open banking is not a system without its pitfalls, but it holds great potential for a fair and more modern financial world one where consumers have freedom to use their money and their data however they see fit. To mitigate risk, regulators have a real part to play, but institutions do too. Maybe also from a technological perspective, what are the things institutions can do to make it safe?
This is sort of the beauty of standardization. The idea of making sure that everyone's doing things the same way sort of automatically creates a more secure, more transparent environment where folks almost have to play fair because they're all singing from the same song sheet. There's no technological moats. This is very similar to the way the internet operates today. The internet came along. Rather than being based on proprietary walled gardens, a website was based on the same technology for everyone. So suddenly anybody could build a website and anybody could have email. You didn't have to pick one provider or another. These different capabilities that were the internet just sort of worked together. In many ways, that's what open banking is bringing to financial services.
It's easy to see why AOL would compare the advent of the internet to what's currently happening in the world of open banking. Both technologies share an ambition for easy access and large-scale integration. But if you're thinking we're getting closer to global adoption, well, there's a slight caveat.
Because banking varies so widely from one country to another, even within a region, trying to create a global open banking system for everybody is not likely to work. What you're in fact seeing is a focus more on interoperability, so that even though each region and country has their own way of approaching open banking, there are efforts to try and make them work with each other. So you would essentially translate between the way one region does open banking and another. They might not be exactly the same, but they could still interoperate.
So you kind of touched upon it already with your vision for how the world is evolving, but let's maybe narrow it down to the next 5 to 10 years ahead. How would you envision that open banking and the world around it is evolving?
What you're going to see over the next little while is more mature standards, better security, which makes it even easier for more players to participate, even easier to drive more innovation out of these systems. For example, in the case of AI, the writer's strike that happened, a couple of years back now, where authors and actors said, we don't feel great about AI just sort of taking our work and our likenesses and our words, using it as training data and be able to regurgitate it without asking us permission. I think open banking is the other side of that coin. The idea that, look, we're not saying AI shouldn't have data. It's an incredibly powerful tool and it should be fostered. But if it's using our data, well, that should be done with our permission. And if there's any value being created out of that data, we should be able to participate in that value creation and maybe remunerated for that value creation. So expect it to get cleaner, better, more utilitarian, more modern, more integrated with some of the newer stuff we're seeing out there in the technology space in general.
Would you say there's also a potential to apply this to other industries? I mean, let's say not only banking, but healthcare data, for example, or also big tech?
Oh, 100%. The idea being that if a customer owns their data in one sphere, then why do they not own their data everywhere? This notion of data sharing based on your consent, your control, is fundamental to the movement. Once people understand that there is a way for them to control their data, to control how it's shared, to turn it off if they don't want it to be shared, there's a certain inevitable march to that idea that it will move to other spheres where you have data that you want to protect, and eventually come to the point that you expect that utility and protection across all of the data that you have, not just banking, not just finance, not just healthcare and telecom, but indeed things that today we have very little control over, like our search histories, like our social media behavior, like our online shopping histories.
Eyal has his eyes on the horizon, and it seems pretty clear. The future of open banking is far-reaching. When he started in the field 6 years ago, only about a dozen authorities were banking on open finance. Now, there are over 90 jurisdictions all around the world pursuing it. Making them work as a unit is not always straightforward. But global actors are innovating and building more mature and inclusive open source systems, one after another. So there's much more to come from the side of fintech. Watch this space.
And follow Eyal's podcast, Mr. Open Banking. I was really struck by his insights, especially with the idea that open banking can lead the way for more diversity and financial inclusion. So let's break this down. We talk here so much about the potential through the podcast, about its ability to support underserved communities and really facilitate inclusion and actual impact. It was cool watching him point out that open banking is not a zero-sum game, which to me is exciting, and it's how we should look at life anyways. Venora, what was your opinion? What was the opportunity that open banking really represented for these developing communities that stuck out to you during the episode?
It's a very good question, and I very much do agree that banks and institutions should work towards being more inclusive and shaping a more inclusive world. So what was really interesting to me was how open banking and creating this standardized way of integrating between institutions, how that enables new products and new market participants to create new products. And especially if you look at underserved customer groups, for example, that maybe wouldn't be interesting to the big banks and big institutions who are just looking at scales and how to optimize the last bit of their margin. But then you can take a smaller fintech or a startup that's operating at a smaller scale, and they have this exciting idea how to offer banking services, for example, to women specifically. I mean, I still remember when the first female investment products popped up, or investment advisors popped up. There was no such thing coming from the big banks. And that is ultimately enabled by open banking. So that I find really fascinating.
I tend to have the same experience. You, for the listeners out there that don't know, I am from Brazil. And when I look at a country with so much discrepancy and in income gaps or just even education, open banking shows the representation of opportunity of what data does that have. Open banking to me is like leading the footsteps of saying, how do we put parameters that allow us to compare information, to allow us to standardize information, to see risk differently. So this notion that API can also help other countries get services that they couldn't get before.
Absolutely.
Is exciting. But I think this highlights another topic that I loved you and Eyal talking about it, which is the importance of how do you manage risk? What did you think when you were talking about the risk and the opportunity, Nora, that this represents?
Open banking, being in Europe, what I find actually a bit sad is that enabling this kind of data sharing and this kind of standardization, how you communicate between institutions, that it had to come through a regulator. It should have been in the bank's own interest, actually, to do that, in my opinion. But on the other side, it is a really good example how regulators can actually enforce innovation. And that is, on the other side, very beautiful. But what's your take on this? I know, I mean, you've been working quite a lot with regulators around the world.
I love my regulators. You probably can't say that, but I love working with them. In Brazil, we've passed on so many changes that I think you can even see what's happening with the fintech market. And that's all to do with a lot of open banking and open data legislation. You've seen financial inclusion, you've seen an impact in, you know, GDP. So this isn't just a make-believe conversation. And I think we've yet to really fully realize the potential for this, the potential for what is my personal data? What do I do with it? Who has to be the guardian, the custodian? What's the responsibility as well? A lot of people only talk about the positives, but like, this is an opportunity for us to redefine citizenship in the digital world. This has been FinTech Files, a podcast from BCG Platinum.
This season, we're digging deep into the groundbreaking ideas that are reshaping the future of fintech. And we want to hear from you, our listeners. What topics do you want us to cover? And who are your dream guests? Feel free to reach out anytime at fintech-podcast@bcgplatinian.com. We can't wait to hear from you. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on FinTech Files.